You're listening to WKXL in the morning on 1450 AM, 103.9 FM, and nhtalkradio.com. I'm AJ Kierstead. It's time for the New Hampshire Business Update with Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. You can check out more from them at nhbr.com. How's it going, Jeff?
Doing very well, AJ. How is everything going with you?
Oh, I'm certainly keeping busy. All right. So let's start off with you actually had an article released on September 9th on Vapotherm. Can you talk about what that was about?
Yeah, that was really interesting. Vapotherm is a company based in Exeter, and they make respiratory treatments and equipment used by hospitals and other medical and other healthcare providers to treat respiratory illnesses. And as you would expect, during COVID, they stepped up their production, and they were, you know, they did very well. Their earnings have been going up increasingly over the last, well, it's a year and a half. And
yeah, pretty much. It looks like at least $120 million for the 21 fiscal year forecast.
Yeah, actually, it seems like 120 years, but that's another thing. But no, it's true. And their numbers are going up. And what they've found out was that what they've decided, which I think is very instructive, because I'm sure they're not the first company to do this, but I think that it's interesting that they're doing this, is that they basically announced that their earnings will be going up dramatically from their original projections to 120 million. Yep. And the other thing was, the reason they're doing this was they're expecting COVID to be with us like the flu and other respiratory viruses for the foreseeable future, and that their products will be in demand from that because of that. And because of that, they are ramping up their capacity in their plant. They have a factory in Mexico, a 75% increase in their capacity. That's the plant that makes what they call the disposable products. It's like the things that are used by hospitals as a one-time thing for respiratory treatment. And that's a good thing for the company, but I think it bodes pretty ill for the rest of us who have to deal with this, because, you know, companies don't make these decisions just with no information. They have a lot more information than we do. And for them to just make this assumption and go public with it for their shareholders, because they have to, when you say something to your shareholders, they're a publicly owned company, you have to make sure that that's true.
Yeah.
Otherwise, or it's based on facts that you have. Otherwise, you will you get in a lot of trouble with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yeah, this definitely, I think, confirms what basically I predicted a year ago was going to be the case, that COVID-19 is going to continue to be an ongoing issue. It's obvious that the vaccine is a miracle drug. I mean, there's no way around that.
Yes.
The Delta variant, it does not stop people from spreading the Delta variant, as so far as we can tell. It may reduce it to a certain extent, but industries like this that are in the vaccine healthcare industry with regards to treating people that are hospitalized, it's going to be a considerable industry probably for the foreseeable future. I mean, someday maybe it'll be like the flu and it'll be a minor thing, but we're probably years away from that being the case.
Well, yeah, actually, to be fair, I mean, flu is not always a minor thing.
Yeah.
And that can be very deadly. COVID is much, much more deadly. The other thing about the comparison with flu is that, you know, the flu, you know, many people get vaccinated. I know I do every year. And they have to have a different flu vaccine because the flu comes up with a variant each year. There's a different variant of the flu that comes here into the United States and other places. So that's, you know, apparently what we might be dealing with COVID is like having a different kind of vaccine. I don't know. Believe me, I'm not a doctor. I don't.
You're not a doctor. You're not a medical expert.
I'm just saying this is just my own, from what I've been reading and hearing, that this is a very good possibility that we'll be dealing with it going forward, and we'll have to adapt our lives to it. And, you know, and I think that many people have made a good job of adapting, but there are still many others who just don't take it seriously. And that does affect the rest of us.
Yeah. It causes these waves to go through certain populations, which I'd imagine those waves kind of are problematic for the business model of companies like Vapotherm. They can't just expect like, okay, there's going to be a steady this amount of stuff coming through. Like there could be 6 months where there is no big wave, like through the winter, for example. It seems like it hits really hard at the beginning of the extremely cold and extremely hot seasons, and then it levels off again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, I was reading something very interesting just actually on Thursday, on the 9th, was that the White House is going to basically spend $2 billion on the same, you know, instant COVID tests for people to distribute them. And the interesting thing is a lot of these makers of the COVID tests, they have ramped down their production because they didn't they haven't found a demand for it, which is because, you know, people just aren't as invested in testing now, which is also one of the problems for the spread of the virus. But apparently these manufacturers, that, you know, they thought that, okay, we're done. We're going to move on to something else. Well, you know, this will be one part of our business model, but these manufacturers will be ramping up a lot now because making 2 billion tests that you just don't buy them at CVS.
Yeah.
You have to produce these things. So it's going to be, we're entering the fall, which we know we went into the fall last year and we had this problem, and we apparently this is going to be deja vu. And it's looking like we're not going to have the end of COVID as we had thought maybe earlier in the spring.
Hopefully, knock on wood here, that it's not as extreme as we experienced last year. Because, I mean, at least so far, it appears that, because last year when the colleges opened back up, there was a huge spike in virus exposure. But at least so far, the numbers are exceedingly low. I saw the University of New Hampshire dashboard today, and it's less than 1% positivity rate. So speaking on September 9th. For the virus. So as long as the numbers stay low enough so everything can stay open, it's going to be fantastic for everyone involved, but definitely testing. I'm really shocked how people just forgot about the fact that there's at-home testing available, and the market just disappeared for it essentially because of that.
Exactly. They're not that they're inexpensive, but they
cost enough to think about it before you get it.
But it's also, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why, I guess, apparently this deal with the White House is coming out was at Walmart and Amazon, and maybe some other retailer is going to provide these things at cost to people. But it's still going to be like $35 for two tests or whatever.
Yeah, that's still pricey.
But if you think of that as an investment to let your life go forward, it's probably a good thing. But the bottom line is that if you got vaccinated, you don't necessarily have to have these problems.
Yeah. Because, I mean, even if you get it,
the bottom line is on this whole thing.
Yeah, so even if you do get it, your symptoms are going to be so much less extreme. And
exactly.
And thank God the children aren't infected to even close to the rates that people that are ages in their late 20s and up are.
I know, because
that would be horrible.
Because that is spiking right now in New Hampshire and elsewhere, that it's children, because they're not vaccinated. They can't even get vaccinated. This is one of the things that, you know, adults are imposing their ideological beliefs or whatever on the kids and on some of the kids. And it's not a healthy situation.
So, all right, well, I guess continue a little bit on the black pilling around COVID. The eviction moratorium is ending. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, we had a moratorium imposed way back at the beginning of COVID. The CDC imposed it, and it was extended for a while by the President Biden. And now it looks like it's ending again. And it does kind of leave a lot of people in a lurch. And I have to say something else, though. There has been literally tens of millions of dollars available in New Hampshire to help prevent people from being evicted. And for some reason, it's not just New Hampshire, it's all across the country, this money is not as accessible as people thought it would be. One of the reasons that, you know, if you talk to landlords, their concern was the money should have gone to them directly without having to deal with the layer of tenants who are facing eviction, having to deal with putting in the paperwork and all this other stuff, because it can be somewhat complicated. It's not, you know, it's not rocket science, but it's not something that people are used to doing, and getting the access to the money is not, it's not as simple as it could be. So what we have is that we have two sets of people who are hurt by this. It's certainly the tenants. If they lose their home, they lose their apartment, it's not good. It's not good for the future for them. It reflects on their credit score, which is, it sounds kind of trite, but that's, you know, something for their whole next 10 years or more. And for the landlords who are not getting their rent. And, that a lot of the landlords who we've talked to are, they're not, you know, there's big landlords, a lot of big landlords in New Hampshire, but there's a lot of people who own, you know, a couple of buildings or even one, and they have a few tenants, and their tenants aren't able to pay their rent. And they've been left holes in the bag in this for over a year and a half, as we say, you know, not necessarily for a year and a half. Some of the tenants have been affected more recently. Others have had a longer term effect, but this has had a ripple effect on many people.
Yeah. Speaking of landlords, I mean, aside from the confusion of trying to get a tenant to fill out the necessary paperwork and ultimately to pay them, have they had any other concerns about how this process has been taking place? It seems like obviously they would want to be like, it seems like the easiest thing is a piece of form that's filled out by both the tenant and the landlord so that it just goes direct to them as a creditor or direct money. It's very strange that this is the process.
Yeah. Well, the problem was that the tenant has the responsibility for filing for the assistance, as opposed to the landlord saying, I have five tenants who are eligible. Let me fill out the paperwork and I can get the money. So, because in that many cases, you know, the landlord has more access. Most of them have lawyers and people could help them do this stuff. And the tenants most likely do not. And the landlords, I think at the beginning, they had suggested that this is the way it should be, but it wasn't done that way. And, the classic is a lot of people don't like landlords, but you know what? In this case, they certainly are making a good point on this, especially in an emergency, to add another layer of bureaucracy that for people who are suffering and struggling anyway through this whole thing. It didn't make any sense.
And for the independent owners, as you're mentioning before, I mean, they may rely on this money to be coming in to afford utilities, which obviously have gone up for fuel, especially, I'd imagine. And God knows what this next winter is going to be entailing for us.
Absolutely. And that's another issue. You know, we're talking about not just the payments of the tenant to the landlord, but the landlord's tenant payment to might very likely has a mortgage or has other kinds of loans associated with the building or buildings. And they have other things. They have a recurring cost like heating, taxes, electricity.
Are taxes water, high in New thing. Hampshire? Are taxes high in New Hampshire? What?
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing that we're talking about. These are things that have gone up and what are you supposed to do about it? If you read the newspapers lately, you see the assessments are going up in cities and towns all across the state, like skyrocketing, because all you have to do is see what the real estate market's been doing. Of course, the values of property has been going up, and that's you can't stop that. You say, well, I'm going through a pandemic. The property, maybe the property has gone up 50%, or even in some cases 100%. I can't do it. So you can't charge me the taxes. That's not happening. You don't see the governmental entities saying that. You don't have to worry about paying your taxes.
And in turn turns people around to say, screw this. The market's amazing. I'm going to sell this property. I'm going to make bank selling it to some large company. Yeah. Like, I don't know how much it's in New Hampshire specifically, but BlackRock is just going gangbusters buying up properties across the country.
Yeah. Private equity companies because they smell the money. They see where it is. And that shows what's going on right now is that there's so much money in the real estate market right now that there are so many pressures on people in real estate in terms of wanting to sell. Should I buy things now? It really, and in the end, what we have is this whole scenario being played out with tenants and landlords, all across New Hampshire and all across the United States.
And these equity firms, when they decide whatever the heck they're going to do with it, they'll turn around and they may not want to keep the people there. They may not want to keep the physical structure there, and they want to rebuild on the property.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is going to be rough.
And the other thing you have to remember, a lot of these landlords who are being affected are providing housing that, you know, in many, many cases is what you would call affordable housing for the most part. You know, it's afforded by people who maybe don't have the best jobs in the world. Maybe they'd be low income, lower middle income people. And, you know, a private equity firm comes in there. They don't look like, well, we're going to buy this and rent it to people who can afford to pay $1,000 a month as opposed to $5,000 a month. No, they don't think that way.
Yeah.
I'm don't trying think to that get way at all.
Yeah, I'm trying to get hopefully next week or this week on the New England Take, my regular show, John Hoyt, who runs Concord Housing and Redevelopment. Yes. He's done extensive work in the Concord area, and I'm really interested to see what they're looking at for their income-based housing. How feasible is that going forward?
Yeah, no, it's you know, actually I have to say that I sit on the board of Catch Affordable Housing, which is a Concord-based organization, and we develop affordable housing, and it's the market's been so crazy, it just makes it difficult to look forward to like try to buy properties to try to, because our mission is to build affordable housing, to create affordable housing and manage it, and it's become much more difficult under this situation.
And with New Hampshire expanding in certain areas, especially around Concord and Manchester, I mean, I was driving through Hooksett the other day and I could not believe the amount of new developments that are just all over the place with condos and apartment buildings and townhouses. There's a huge demand to expand with more high-end apartments for people that either want to commute to the Boston area or all the businesses blowing up in Manchester right now.
Yeah, and that's another aspect of this is that, you know, there's housing being built in New Hampshire because there's been a great demand for it, but it's very little of it is what you would call affordable workforce housing. You know, towns are very eager. Towns and cities, I don't want to talk. Cities have a different mission, but towns across the state have been very strongly effective in preventing the development of affordable housing when they want to within their borders. And there's many of them that stand out as pretty egregious in their attempts to keep affordable housing out. And what it does is it just makes it concentrated in cities for the most part and other, you know, in some larger towns. And it's a situation where there's limited amounts of land and property in the cities and the larger towns. And in these smaller towns, maybe they're small by population, but they have a lot of area. There's a lot of, you know, square miles to them, and they're preventing it. So we got a squeeze that's very specifically geographic at this point. And at this point, I think the state, which is trying to make some inroads in this, needs to really step up on this, because our affordable housing problem is extreme, and I'd say dire at this point. And you know, dancing around, you know, just playing around the edges on this thing is not working.
And that just goes to this is just horrible that only $38 million of the roughly $200 million in federal funds have come out from the rental assistance program.
Yes. I mean, that's another matter. You know, the rental assistance, the eviction prevention stuff is temporary. It's a temporary fund.
Yeah.
It's a temporary solution, actually, because, you know, it's when that dries out, there won't be any money left to help prevent people from getting evictions. But the long-term, very, very severe problem we have is the lack of housing that people can afford, that a lot of people can afford, is really the way to put it. It's so expensive now in New Hampshire to find a place to rent, even in the North Country where, you know, it's historically been, you know, lower priced rentals and housing, that it's become, as I said, it's a dire situation. This needs to be done because this affects all of us. When people can't find places to live, appropriate places to live, they're not going to stay in New Hampshire. They're not going to be here to work. businesses will not be able to find employees. They'll have to go someplace else to find employees. And they may say, well, you know, we'll just move now. Why do we have to stay in New Hampshire? We can't find people to work. You know, New Hampshire's always, you know, historically has been famous for its workforce, for its strong, you know, the strong work ethic of the people who work here. But it's not going to last forever if we can't find places to house people.
All right, listen to Cakes on the Morning. Been joined by Jeff Feingold of the New Hampshire Business Review. Check out more from them at nhbr.com.